Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is the Emergency Nine Golf Podcast. I am Mike Maroney, alongside co-host McLean Boyd, Jay Woodson. Gents, what's going on?
Nothing. Nothing at all. We're just working through some internet issues. And
yeah, I'm getting ready to throw this thing. So to all the listeners, if there's any issues, I apologize. I've been in about 40 minutes here of fighting with a computer and Wi-Fi. It's not a good situation right now. Not a great situation going on in my household right now. So I mean, everyone's asleep in my house. Like, there's just no devices on.
No reason.
I got like four boosters in this house, hotspot things, whatever you want to call them. I don't know. Spent enough money on this bullshit, should work.
So the effort's there, the execution's just not quite there.
That's what happens when you live in the country. Fucking mouse stopped running on its wheel.
So let's go ahead and get into it. Let's talk rollback.
I think we're never talking rollback again after last week.
You didn't see the point I was trying to make. Like, you totally misread what the point I was trying to make. Then you got on your high horse and over-talked me.
No, I didn't get on my high horse, and I'm not talking about this. I actually had two listeners who are on your side of the rollback argument say they almost went to my side of the argument because when they listened to you last week.
Well, they were wrong.
I'm not doing this. I just want to leave it
the way it is. I get that Augusta has had to lengthen the golf course. Just leave it the way it is. Golf is good the way it is. Let's just leave it there.
Oh, love it. Let's just get the juices flowing. The 3 minutes in. Let's do this.
Let's just leave it the way it is. We don't need to make any changes. The Augusta doesn't need to add a different tee box. Let's just stay where we are. The golf course is perfect. We had a great week 2 weeks ago. I think we just leave it the way it is.
I'm definitely cutting out the last 45 seconds. Nobody wants to hear that.
That'd be a detriment to the viewership, the listening public. But you know, you do you, Mike.
I will. I have the listeners at heart here, and been hearing from some folks. And if that's what you want to fall on Augusta National as your poster child for the rollback argument, then I actually should just
That's what I was saying, though. That's why you missed it. All I was saying is that it is good the way it is. Things are good the way they are. That's all I was saying.
Except for the fact that they have to lengthen the golf course every year. So they don't say it the way it is.
Mike, it's good the way it is now. We don't need to lengthen it.
When they add another golf hole next year.
We don't need to. They're not going to. They're going to leave it the way it is because that's all it needs to be. It was good. Great championship. Just leave it the way it is. Good the way it is. We don't need to make more changes.
I might just sign off and let you guys just run the show tonight.
No, don't do that. I'm gonna kind of be a bipartisan here. I'm gonna kind of hang the fence here and so. Obviously, the guys are hitting it further, and we all know that there's something needs to change at some point. Hold strong, buddy. Hold on. Hear me out. I do think there's something needs to be done. I don't know if it's rollback. Do we shorten the ball? The length of the ball. I don't know if I really love that. But the one thing that I will say is everyone keeps talking about, again, the obstacles on the golf course. We have rough. We have, wind, which you can't predict. You know, you have the firmness of the greens. You have speed.
Trees. You have trees.
And we have trees, and I hate to bring that up. And I know that every green superintendent says, I'm in the business of growing grass, not growing trees. But at the same time, and my argument to that is you're in the business of maintaining a golf course and maintaining the integrity of the golf course and the toughness of the golf course. And I do think there is something to be said for trying to maintain that at in the best way that they can. And everyone says, well, we look back, Donald Ross and Tillinghast, they all like, they look at their designs. Let's return the golf course to the original design. And I will say to that, like, most of these guys built golf courses on plots of land that didn't have trees. So it wasn't like they were, you know, one, because they didn't have enough money to knock down all these trees to build the golf courses they wanted. So they found plots of land that were bigger, more open, and they didn't have trees. So yes, I can build the golf courses that I know that are similar to maybe what I see over in Scotland and Ireland. So if I have a big forest, I'm not going to go in and do all this demo work because it's expensive. So they build these golf courses on these more of these open fields. So with that being said, yes, they designed these golf courses, you know, 100 years ago on plots of land that didn't have a lot of trees, because I think it was more cost efficient and more cost effective to do so. But that doesn't necessarily mean that is better. And there are a lot of golf courses that have been built with trees, and I think they're great. So, and they add an added deterrent there for the players to figure out how to work their way around. I understand that it's tougher to grow grass with more trees. I get that. But I do think there's a balance, and I don't think that we need to mow every tree down. I do think that trees are there. They're an obstacle. And they've been there for a long time in terms of, you know, especially in the U.S., a lot of golf courses. So I think there's a balance. I think there's a balance to mowing down trees. And I think that's something that should be there. I think we should not just completely assume that we need to go back to the original design of the architect. Courses change every year. And they get, you know, trees grow, and that's what that is what it is. And if that's the case,
well, what's your Jay? What's your thought on rough height? Do you want to see rough more penalizing, or do you want to see it being something that comes out with just a little bit less spin? I played a golf course today that had very penalizing rough, and you had to really look at how your ball came out of that rough and judge the lie correctly in order to hit a good shot. And while I was a victim of it in multiple scenarios because I didn't hit the fairway, I thought it was fair. What's your thought on rough? I mean, I saw a lot of rough at the Masters. I'm not putting any shade on Augusta, but at the same time, it looked like for the most part, there wasn't anything really grabbing the club. Are you okay with having a more penalizing rough?
I think it's just a balance, you know. And I think Mike, you would agree with this. Like, I don't think there's one perfect way. I don't think it's like, okay, we need all trees. I think we need thick rough. I think we need, you know, firm greens. I think it's a balance. I think, you know, having that kind of the ebbs and flows of the, you know, the golf course architectures throughout the year on the PGA Tour, just from a viewership standpoint, like, okay, we've got, like, last week, RBC Heritage, like, there's a lot of trees out there. There's not a whole lot of rough. I mean, they don't really need rough, like, because the trees are the deterrent, the trees are the obstacle. And then at some courses, say you go to Oakmont, you know, obviously they've mowed down every tree. So, yeah, obviously having a thicker rough is the deterrent to find a way to hit the ball in the fairway. So I think it just depends on the golf course and the setup. If you've got, you know, a tighter tree line golf course, then, you know, having super thick rough is not maybe necessary. But if it's wide open, then you need, you know, water. I mean, and that's the other thing we don't even talk about. Like, look at like the Honda, look at PGA National. Like, there's not a whole lot of trees there. But there is some obstacle there, you know. Again, it's easier for the superintendent to grow grass, but there's like water in 17 of the 18 holes, you know. So I think the trees, water, rough, they're all obstacles. And I think they all present another deterrent for the players and for the viewership. It's something different to look at. So if we played every golf course that looked like PGA National, that'd be very boring for the viewership. And if we played every golf course that looked like Firestone, you know, in Ohio with tree line golf course, I mean, that would be boring. I think the variability of the golf courses and can continue to make them different. I think that's what makes it cool about being a tour player, is like you're going from one setting to the next, different grass, different setup, harder greens, different grass, trees, thick rough, no rough. You know, that's what makes the variability is what makes it cool for a professional. So back to the main point with the rollback, obviously, you know, I know we don't really want to dig deep on this, but I think just in the game of golf, game of golf, though, I know this is you know, outside of just rollback, just like, you know, Mike, I know we even want to talk about this, like just the popularity of golf and where it is right now. Obviously, viewership is kind of dropping back, it seems like, for the most part. So like, how do we make this more popular? And I think the more variability, the more drama, the better for the viewership. They want to see different things. They want to see different, different potential results. You know, they want to see someone different win, I shouldn't say someone different, but they want to see the players tested in a different way. They don't want to see the same thing every week, right? Because then it's like, okay, I'll just watch something different. But if you have a course, I agree. Go ahead.
No, I agree with all the points you make. I think a scenario that would make it interesting is that, let's say it's a 430 or 4. That's the last hole, and you're both tied for lead. One guy hits the fairway, one guy hits it into the rough. And the guy in the rough can't land it within 10 feet of the flag and spin the golf ball. He has to figure out the way to manipulate that golf ball and land it well short with a different loft, control his launch, control his spin. It requires more skill in order to create that golf shot, or it could be even more difficult. He may not even be able to do that, but because the fact that he missed the fairway, there's a penalty involved in that. And the guy that did hit the fairway, he has a crisp, clean shot looking at it. I mean, I see a lot of times where you have a guy in the fairway and a guy in the rough at the same distance, and they're both able to land the ball close to the hole and see some spin back up from it, because that rough doesn't penalize that player that just hit it just outside of the fairway. I think there's some opportunities where that player should be penalized more. And also, it doesn't say that he can't create that shot. If he's at 113 yards, maybe he takes a gap wedge and he has to land it 20 yards short, and he has to control his flight spin and allow that ball to run up to create the golf shot that he's looking to create, versus the guy that's in the fairway and is able to land it 5 feet behind the hole and suck it back right there, you know, inside the grip. So I just think there's some opportunities with rough and rough length that would allow for the skill set that the better players have to find. And ultimately, again, if you miss the fairway, there should be some sort of penalty involved. Now, what that delta is up for discussion. But again, I think we've seen a lot of golf tournaments where guys are hitting in the rough and they're able to hit a wedge in there and spin it back. And it's like, or spin it to a certain amount that they're able to fly the golf ball
and control the ball. Have the ball stop
and control the golf ball. I don't think that's the applicable penalty for that situation. I think there should be more of it. I think they should have to create more artistry, create more of a golf shot in order to be successful from those locations.
Yeah. You know, if that does happen, though, Scottie Scheffler is going to win by 15 shots.
I don't even stop. Mike, I'm sorry. You've been a little bit quiet here. Did you want to weigh in? I'm sorry.
No, I mean, you guys have been talking for 15 minutes straight. So I don't really want to get into this, because kind of what we're talking about has nothing to do with the rollback argument.
Yeah, no, I mean, you know, we kind of stemmed off of the rollback, but I think it is.
So here's the thing. We've talked rough and trees on this podcast 100 times, and I'll say what I always say. When you have long, thick rough, it takes away skill and creativity because it's just a gouge. I don't disagree that a poor drive. Let me talk, McLean. You've had 10 minutes to talk. Let me talk.
I didn't.
When you hit a poor drive, you should be penalized. But to me, just thick rough is boring because one, the ball stops rolling. It just stops after 2 yards. Like, I'd rather see no rough. Like at Augusta, there's no rough and the ball runs into the trees. It runs into trouble. Now there's creativity. Okay, now I got a funky lie in pine straw or the woods, or I got to manipulate balls around, over, under trees. Just gouging out of the rough is one skill involved, strength. That's it. It's just strength. And so then when you factor around the green, it's boring. I just played a golf course last week that I love, Muirfield Village, and the rough was unbelievably penal. But when you missed around the green, everyone just grabbed their log webs and it was a chunk and run. It's not fun. It's not as interesting or fun, and it takes away some skill. When you have shaved down areas, and again, I've said this 100 times on this podcast, and I'm not sure why we're doing this again, but when you have short grass around greens and you have wide fairways where the ball's running into trouble, you have to control your ball. You have to control your ball when it lands on the ground too, not just in the air, but when it lands on the ground. When the ball just rolls 2 yards and goes to the rough and stops, you don't really have to control shit. And so I think there's way more skill involved when there's less rough.
So I totally agree with you around the greens. I totally agree with you around the greens. And I do think there's a fine line between what's too much and what's over penalizing rough. I think there's a happy medium there in the depth of rough outside the fairways. Again, I'm all for having more shaved down areas around the green that allow activity, that allow for a multitude of shots to be played. I'm in agreement with you 100%. As much as that will shock everyone listening to this podcast, I'm in agreement.
I think they've already turned the podcast off by now.
Personally, I just think they haven't because they love this shit. I just think personally, you can widen the areas around the greens, give more short grass availability around the greens. And I just think ultimately there could be a happy medium of rough. And I'm not a superintendent. I'm not going to tell you what that length is. But when you looked at, and again, I'm not trying to talk negative on Augusta, but guys didn't struggle to create spin out of the rough at Augusta. I think there is
no rough. They just have a secondary cut. I mean,
that's what I'm saying. That's what I'm saying.
I wouldn't even consider it rough at Augusta.
I don't disagree. I think this is the greatest venue on earth. I'm not saying anything negative about Augusta because I think the place is amazing. I don't want to end up on a fucking blacklist. But on the backside of that, I think there is an opportunity that if I drive it in the rough from 160 yards, I might not be able to just go in there with a 9 or an 8 iron, flight it high, and be able to spin and control it on the green. That's all I'm saying. I think there's opportunities to make golf courses a little bit tougher and more penalizing on the drive, and reward great drives, reward drives that are down the middle, and penalize the ones that are, you know, off track. I think there's other ways to make golf courses a little bit more difficult than technically rolling a ball back.
But I don't think distance is necessarily the issue. But they're not trying to make the golf courses more difficult. That's the thing that you don't get. And I'm not going down this rabbit hole. I'm not. No, but you don't even understand.
I get that. What
they're trying to do.
I get that. I understand exactly what they're trying to do. I just think there's a better way of doing it.
They're not trying to make the game harder for the pros. They have never said the scores are too low. That's not what they're doing.
They have said that the scores are too low?
They've never said that. They've never said the scores are too low, and that's why they're making this decision. They have not said that. I would love for you to show me where they have said that.
So, okay. All good.
I don't think you actually get what their argument is. It comes down to sustainability in golf courses. Because not everyone has the money Augusta National has to spend $25 million to lengthen the 13th hole by 20 yards.
I don't think you need to make the golf course more playable. I personally don't.
Okay. All right. Scottie Scheffler wins again at the RBC Heritage. Scotty going to lose ever again?
I don't think so.
You know, the Ruffites the way they are, he can't lose.
I don't think he's going to lose. I honestly don't. I mean,
well, I mean,
he obviously will. I'm joking, but like the way he's playing.
But he's currently world number 1, 2, and 3. Like Rory's at best 4 right now, and Scotty takes up the top 3 spots.
So here's a crazy stat. Currently, Rory McIlroy is closer in world golf rankings to the 3 of us than he is Scottie Scheffler.
That big of a gap, yeah. Right? That's like some Tiger
Rory
Woods
McIlroy's
shit right there.
Point total. Rory McIlroy's point total, he is second in the world, is 7.3. Okay, that would put him 7.3 away from 0, what the 3 of us are at. Scottie Scheffler's
is there,
over.
Is there
15.
A negative in the world ranking points?
I don't think so. I think they just cap it at 0. I tried to find it today, but Scottie Scheffler's over 15. He's more than double Rory McIlroy in the world golf rankings right now.
It's correct. This is one of the first times that I can go back and say, like, world ranking, you got it right. Like, this guy is definitely double the next closest competitor. He certainly is.
Yeah, I mean, it's, again, I hate to make the analogy, but we've never seen anything like it since Tiger. We don't know when it's going to end. I mean, the crazy part in this is, we're all parents, and the guy's getting ready to have a baby. Your lunges, as we all know, when you have your first child, what's this going to do to him? Is he able to keep going? I mean, like, this is such a paramount point in his life. What does it look like moving forward? I mean, he's going to have this kid, and as we all know, he's going to lay eyes on this kid and his life will change immediately. I have such a hard time saying this. I really do. I have such a hard time saying this. But if Meredith wasn't pregnant, does he win like the next like 15 events? I mean, and he may still, I mean, I don't want to look at this like a negative. I mean, the guy is unbelievable, and I love my kids. I love parenthood. He's going to be so happy with so many things outside of golf by having this addition to his family, and I congratulate him for that. I think it's just amazing. But that's the only thing that can get in his way right now. Like, it literally is. It's the only thing I think that can get in his way. And your perspective changes, your mental game changes, your life changes. We can all three agree that when you have your firstborn, your life is, you know, it's shaken up a bit. So is he able to come back after Meredith has the baby and still be as dominating as he's been? I don't know. But outside of that, I mean, there's nothing that can stop him. Just an amazing player. It's almost a foregone conclusion when he's in the lead. It's like, oh yeah, this is a done deal at this point. And now, mind you, 9 weeks ago, we may have said something different. But based off of current performance, it's hard to look at him and say Scheffler's in the field. Yeah, I'm taking Scheffler for the W.
Yeah, I think that's something that's going to happen over time, and he's definitely over the last year and a half, 2 years, he's proven that. What he won the 2021-2022 season, he won 4 events, and then last year he won 2, and then this year he's already won 4, and we're only through April. The guy's got a good, pretty good trend going, and on top of that, you look at, I mean, outside of Tiger, obviously Tiger, you know, 20 years ago, you know, late 90s to early 2000s, all the way to 2009. So that would be what, let's just call it 15 years ago since Tiger Woods dominated the golf scene. You know, he had a couple flash years here in the last 15 years where he played really well. But for the most part, you know, 97 to 2009, that 12-year stretch, Tiger dominated. There was not even close. It wasn't even close to a player. No player even competed with him. And then after that, with injuries and so forth. So you look at the situation that we have here now, and then you look at the players that are competing with him, Scotty Scheffler. And I don't think there's anybody that's even close. You know, I'm a big Rory fan. I like Rory, but when was the last time Rory was really, really dominating? That was almost 10 years ago.
Did he ever really dominate, almost
as far back as when he was on the tail end of when Tiger was relevant. And then no one really. And then the other people that were even close to dominating the sport, Dustin Johnson, John Rahm, and Brooks Koepka, from a major standpoint, don't play on the PGA Tour anymore.
Did Rory ever really dominate, though?
He had a pretty good stretch there.
When Liv took off.
I would say he had a good stretch there in the early teens, where he was winning at a good clip and won a couple majors, and he was still young. So I think you're right. Maybe part of the potential of what he could do, it was the buzz around that.
I'm looking at it. Rory in 12 won four times in a major. He didn't win in 13, but then he won three times in 2014 in two majors, plus a WGC, twice in 15, twice in 16. He won four times in 2019, including the players.
That was the live. That was the live buzz.
The what?
I feel like that was the live
before
buzz.
The live buzz.
Yeah, that was 2019.
I feel like that was when it was just getting started. They were starting to talk about it, and he started to take a stance. I mean, maybe I'm wrong, and it just.
Yeah, it wasn't that long ago.
It is 2024. Well,
but the other thing I can say to this, I mean, think about outside of Rory. I mean, Rory's, you know, his own unique person here in the last 15 years, and his own unique talent. But if you look back at some of the other players that have been some prominent players have won majors in the last 10 years, I think Jordan Spieth is at the top of the list. People, at least in America, Justin Thomas, people love Justin Thomas. You think about these players, you put them at the top. Dustin Johnson, he's no longer here. But you look at these players and then you talk to their coaches, I think, which is pretty unique. And Scottie Scheffler's coach, Randy Smith, has gone on record saying that Scottie Scheffler is the best player that he's ever coached in his entire career. And Randy has coached, he's been around for 40 plus years coaching players. I mean, he has seen, and he's been coaching professional golfers, not just like amateur golfers. So, who is Jordan Spieth's coach again? I don't know why I can't think of his name all of a sudden.
Cameron McCormick.
McCormick. Man, McCormick's a great teacher. He's taught a lot of great players. I've never heard Cameron McCormick say Jordan Spieth is the best player that he's ever coached. I think he will give Jordan Spieth some great attributes and say, hey, Jordan Spieth is great at this, this, and this. But like, he will never come out and say, hands down, he is the best player that I've ever coached. Like, it's not even close. Randy Smith is gone on record saying, like, this guy is the most incredible talent that I've ever been a part of, and I've ever been around. And this is going back to when Scottie Scheffler's a teenager. So to that question, like, is this sustainable for Scottie Scheffler to keep doing this? I think it is. Like, I think everyone's like, oh, what happens when his footwork gets a little weird and he can't hit the ball? I think Scottie will figure it out. Like, I'm not saying Scottie's going to win 20 majors. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying, like, Scottie Scheffler is going to be around and he's not going away. Like, yeah. He's not going away. Yeah. He just played last year and was the number one player in the world, and he only won two times, and he putted, he was one of the worst putters on tour. He went through a stretch of putting incredibly, incredibly poorly and still was the number one player in the world. And now he's putting just around average and he is winning every other event that he plays in. So again, I the guy's not going away. I don't care if he has another bad stretch and he's not driving the ball as well, or he's hitting on his irons as well as he could because his feet are moving all over the place. He's still going to be in the mix. The guy's not going away. I mean, when it comes to golf and the physicality of the game and what he's doing now is not going away, unless, you know, anything can happen. Obviously, if something crazy happens and he gets injured or something like that, then, you know, that's another thing. But when it comes to him and what he's in control of, if he's in control of it and everything's good and he's healthy, the guy's not going away for another 15 years. He's gonna win 5 to 7 majors before he's done. It wouldn't surprise me if he gets to 10. How many players do we have at 10 or plus majors? Not even a dozen, or half a dozen. I'm sorry,
four or five. I can tell you in a second. There's only three guys: Nicklaus with 18, Woods with 15, Hagen with 11. Hogan and Player had 9 majors.
I mean, that would be
one. So here's a good comp, or here's a career. I mean, let's take Tiger out of this. He now has 10 wins, 2 majors. Does he get to Phil Mickelson? 45 wins, 6 majors.
Yeah. I think he does. I think he gets 10 majors, and I think he gets 60 PGA Tour wins.
I mean, that's, now you're talking all-time great.
All-time. I think he's one of, I think he's going to be top 5 greatest players of all time.
So if he gets to 10 majors, he becomes, I guess, what, the fourth, from what I said, fourth most winningest major winner. And if he gets to 60 wins, Arnold Palmer is 5th with 62. So he would be 6th all time. So he's would become one of the all time greats.
3rd in majors, 6th.
Fourth in majors, 6th. If he gets to 60 and 10, he'd be 4th in majors, 60th, or 6th, excuse me, overall wins on the PGA Tour.
I think he does that.
If we have a PGA Tour in a couple of years,
I think we will.
But yeah, I mean, it's kind of mind-boggling. It's kind of hard to, like, you know, we do a podcast every week and we're talking about the same guy now every week. It's kind of hard to find different ways to say the same thing, you know. The guy's really fucking good.
The guy's really unbelievable. Good. He just doesn't have a week. You know, I mean, at this point, you know, we talked about his putting many times on this podcast, but right now, he's hitting it good enough to putt the way he's putting, and he just gets it done. I mean, what's there's not a whole lot.
Yeah.
Awkward silence.
No, I agree 100%.
Yeah. Sorry. My computer actually froze for a second, so I missed the 10 seconds of what you said. So, what else did you make of the RBC? Anything else?
I mean, I think it's a great venue. I think it's a great venue. I'm glad they made it a elevated event. I think ultimately you get a great crop of players there, that you have some short hitters that can be contention. You have long hitters that can be in contention. And ultimately, I think it's just a great venue. I think it brings everyone, it evens everyone out. And it allows guys, you really got to shape your golf ball around that golf course. And I think it allows for a lot of good players to ultimately have a chance at winning the trophy, no matter how far they hit it.
Should it be the week after the Masters?
No, I agree with that. I agree with that. I think it's too good of an event to be the week after the Masters. Yeah. I think historically it's been the week after the Masters because of proximity. But I think ultimately, if it is we get lucky now because it's an elevated event. If it is in a different point of the schedule, I think you still get everyone, but I think you don't get the Masters lull.
Yeah, I even think there's like a Masters lull from the viewers, right? Because I think everyone's so like horned up for the Masters and they're uber focused and they're watching the leaderboard from Thursday morning and they're watching a ton of coverage and probably the most coverage they watch all week. And I think some people are like, oh, okay, well, I have to go like see my family this weekend and like spend time with them because my wife and kids are pissed that I spent all last weekend in front of the TV. Yeah. And so I don't know if you get quite the interest or eyeballs from the viewers. I'm sure the players are like, oh, can we have like an off week or,
have a crap event to take a breath? I agree that having an off week after the Masters is a good thing because everyone gears up for it for so long. And then having an elevated event the next week, I think it's tough on the players. I think ultimately you could have this in a different point of the schedule. You could have it right after the Florida swing, for example. You know, that's not necessarily a big issue proximity wise. I think this venue is fantastic. And I think ultimately it deserves its due. But having it the week after the Masters has always been a tough. That's why until it was an elevated event, you didn't have a great field there.
Yeah. Oh, did we mention with Scotty going back to how good he is? He just played a 9-hole practice round. He went home to celebrate in Texas for a couple of days and then flew there late and just kind of like half-assed his preparation for this tournament and still won by 3 or 4, whatever it was.
Sounds good.
He's legit unreal.
It's kind of crazy, kind of silly. Speaking of someone else who's playing good golf, do you guys watch any of Nelly Korda or any of the Chevron?
Yeah, I did.
She's unbelievable. So if Scotty doesn't miss that 5-footer to go into playoff with Stefan Jaeger, and let's say he makes that and then wins, they would have both gone back to back 5-5-5.
Is that any good?
Yeah, it's pretty good.
I mean, she seems to have it. I've watched a couple, bits and pieces of her wins now in the last few weeks. She seems to kind of have it on like autopilot. You know, she hits a couple more squirrely shots than Scotty does, but not pretty good. And her putting has gotten a lot better. That was always kind of one of her downfalls. She seems like a little bit of a better headspace. As well, more relaxed. She doesn't seem as sometimes you'd look at her out there and she'd seem like really tense or uptight.
Yeah.
She seems just like the perfect mix of confident but not cocky. And man, I mean, the LPGA can't draw this up any better, not to sound shallow or whatever, but you have a young, attractive, blonde American.
The hell?
As the face of the LPGA tour. I don't mean to sound insensitive but that helps. That's a marketing win right there.
100%. Yeah, I mean it is what it is. You can call it whatever you want. She's very articulate. She's easy to listen to, and obviously she's an attractive girl, and people want to pay attention to her. But I don't want that to deter from how good she is. Like, and that's what's cool. And I think in the end of the day, there's a lot of guys and a lot of girls on the LPGA and the PGA Tour that could be good looking, marketable people, but if you're not good at golf, like it's like, okay, whatever. Like he's a good looking guy. She's a good looking girl, but they're not that great. But if you're good at your craft and you're marketable and you're attractive, people want to watch you, then that's a home run. I mean, let's be honest. I'm not trying to, like you said, we're not trying to, numb the situation. It is what it is. Like it, that's the American way here. If you're good at your craft and you're attractive and you're a marketable person, then people are going to want to watch you, and I think she's doing a great job. Absolutely. At that. Good for her. And more importantly, she's freaking good. Like she's good. Really good.
She's only 25. You know, I think
she's only 25.
She came out, you know, she didn't go to college, right? She turned pro at 18.
Yeah.
So she's been around a while. And so she's always had these high expectations. And maybe some
and her sister, her sister kind of paving the way helped.
Yeah.
You know,
and
Jessica,
I think she's always kind of had been this unfair criticism of her. And, you know, so maybe it took her a little bit. Everyone could tell she's had a ton of talent. And now she's starting to put it together. And she's only 25. So it's not like, oh, man, what took her so long? Like, it made sound like it took her so long because she's been pro for 7 years.
And the women's game is a little different, you know, depending on what their goals are for their career and their family life. You know, it's sometimes it ends a little earlier. Once they get in the early 30s, they're like, okay, I'm having kids. I'm going to take a year off. I don't know what her plans are. But at 25, 26, she's on top of the world right now, you know, which is kind of cool to see. I mean, it's I actually turned on the LPGA event with the, I had my boys at the we were sitting around. They had lacrosse practice or whatever, and we were doing stuff in the yard, and we're like, it's like, all right, end of the day, I was like, let's go watch to see if Nelly Korda is going to win five in a row. And they're like, okay. And they, we sat down and watched it, and that's another topic. I know we're going to bring it up. It took forever. It was painful to kind of watch this because she played three holes in like an hour and a half. And I was like, good gracious, is this thing going to end? Like, what's going on here? So that's another topic, but we were intently watching, and she made a couple bogeys coming down the stretch. You could tell she was a little, you know, a little nervy, and she wanted to kind of finish it off, and she obviously did. And she had a great shot on 18, par five, and hit up there in two and two putted and ended up winning. But, you know, again, like we talked about last week, like what's better for the men's game, what's better for the women's game. And I was thinking about this weekend when they were talking about Nelly Korda winning five in a row. Like, would I have turned on the TV to watch Nelly Korda win five in a row, or would I have turned on the TV to watch Rose Zhang and Nelly Korda battle it out, and they hadn't won an event in over a year and a half? I wouldn't have probably turned it on. You know, I turned it on because I was getting ready to watch history, you know, the third player to ever win five straight LPGA events. That's why I turned it on, you know, and that's cool. I mean, that's great. I mean, I think that's, you know,
would anyone talk about college basketball if it wasn't for Caitlin Clark, you know,
exactly. Like, I watched the finals. I watched a lot of the NCAA tournament for that women's basketball, because of her, you know, and that's, you know, you hate to say that, you know, but people want to watch greatness. They want to watch something that they have never seen or that they may never see again. I think that's even more important is that they want to say, I don't know if I'm ever going to see someone like this play again. Maybe, maybe not, but I'm going to make sure I tune in to say I was there when Caitlin Clark did X, Y, and Z, or obviously she didn't end up winning the national championship, but she led us, you know, severely undermatched team. Like, it wasn't even close. South Carolina, that team is incredible. Obviously they went undefeated the entire year. It wasn't even close. But the reason it was even close is because they had Caitlin Clark, you know? So same thing with Nelly Korda. Like, you're like, I'm going to tune into this LPGA event that I have not watched all year. Because wait a second, this I'm getting ready to witness greatness. There could be a potential for this not to happen for another 50 years. And I'm going to say I knew, or I remember when I watched Nelly Korda win five straight to join the likes of Annika Sörenstam and
Nancy Lopez.
Like, and that's pretty cool, really cool.
Actually, especially, you know, a major as well.
So I'm all about it. I'm pulling hard for her. I want her to see her win six, seven, eight. I want her to do it because Yeah. You know, I think, you know, to your, you know, we've talked about this before on the podcast, and you're a father of two girls, and I've got a, you know, a wife who is an incredible athlete. And like, I think that I just, there's so many good qualities that these women have when it comes to sports. And like, they're so good. They're so detailed, and they're so, you know, precise. Like, I think it needs to be showcased. And I think this is a great vehicle for, you know, just women's sports in general, but obviously mainly women's golf, like to show how good they are. And like, if we have somebody that's dominant, similar to what we had with Annika Sorenstam, like I watched a lot of women's golf when Annika was playing, because I was like, what is this lady doing that's so good? Like, can I copy this? Like, is, because it's working. You know, and mm-hmm. same thing for Nelly. You're just kind of looking at him like, all right, this girl, five in a row, like she's got something that's working right. Let's watch it, you know, and that, you know, that breaks down barriers, obviously, you know, across the board, whether it's male, female, whatever. She's good at golf. Let's watch it. Let's pay attention. Let's do it. Like, let's copy it, you know?
Yeah. And cool. So kind of leading into kind of what you just said, into our next topic that you teased. And so, I got two young girls and trying to get them a little bit interested in golf. And, you know, for my birthday in September, I'm taking them up to Solheim Cup. I said, you know, it's in Virginia. Mm-hmm. I said, girls, we're going to go up to the Solheim Cup one day and you're going to watch, you know, we'll put red, white, and blue ribbons in your hair and face tattoos and, you know, they'll get all geeked up for it. And so I flipped it on and I'm like, hey, girls, we're going to go see Nelly Korda. We're going to go see her later this year. She's going to win five in a row. And then I'm like, hey, she's going to jump in this pond after, like, let's watch. And they lost attention pretty quickly because it was not exciting, because the pace of play, like you said, it was abysmal.
Super slow.
And they're like, oh, wow, when's she going to hit again? I'm like, in a minute, 5 minutes later, like, you know, it's like,
yeah,
wait, how many holes she got left? She's got three. Oh, is she done with the hole yet? No, not done with the hole yet. Like, when is she jumping in the pond? I thought she was going to jump in a pond. I'm like, she is. So, like, the pace of play, and it was drastic, and a lot of people were talking about it because, you know, one, I think a lot of people watched the Nelly Korda thing. RBC was in a rain delay, right? And so I think a lot of people flipped on Chevron because it's Nelly winning five in a row, and so it's gotten a lot of attention. Then they had a six-hour round. Was their final round was 6 hours?
Yeah, that's ridiculous. That's,
and so this isn't just an LPGA thing. This is, yeah, nuts. How do we, I say we, how does the professional golf game speed up pace of play? You right. So part of it is, let me preface this a little bit too with, you know, in Theo Epstein. Okay, so hopefully everyone knows who Theo Epstein is. He's one of my heroes. He was the architect of the Red Sox, broke the curse, went on and broke the curse with the Cubs, one of the best executives in baseball. Then he worked for Major League Baseball for a little bit. Now he is with Fenway Sports Group, who was obviously heavily invested in SSG, which is now invested in PGA Tour. He gave a presentation to the board last week on some of the things baseball has done. Because baseball was losing viewers. Baseball's demographic was getting older. And they had to speed up the game, do some younger things, change some things. And so far, it's starting to work. And so he gave a presentation. But I think number one is pace of play. How do we speed this up for today's generation to make it a little bit more engaging, interesting? Because sitting there with my daughters, it was like glaring. Because I know how golf is. They don't. They're like, I want to see. You're telling me this girl's unbelievable. I want to watch her, you know?
Yeah.
I want to watch her hit the shots. And it's like, where the hell is she?
We've seen the shot clock introduced in professional baseball. And I got to be honest, I think it's made the game way better. Way better.
Yeah.
I'm not saying we have to put golf pros on a shot clock, but I think there's a happy medium somewhere to where, one, you have to start penalizing players. They don't feel a need to get quicker because they're not losing anything by doing so. And there has to be, like I said, there has to be some sort of happy medium between putting them on a shot clock speeding up the pay, penalizing players. And I don't have, I do not have the solution to the answer, but, or solution to the problem. But at the same time, it has to come somewhere where it hits people where it hurts. I mean, watch a baseball game. Now with the shot clock, it is so much better. And I'm not saying we need to have all of a sudden and put a shot clock on golfers, but buddy, we're close. Like something has to happen around that to a certain extent to where all of a sudden they know it's your turn and a clock enters the argument to where play, get to your ball quicker, get your data quicker, make a decision, hit a golf shot.
I would agree with that. Yeah. No, I was going to say the same thing, McLean. I don't know if we're at a shot clock, because the only thing that the deterrent there for the shot clock is like, when do you start the clock? You know, for
absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I mean, you obviously led to that and said you're not sure when that would make sense, but like, there's got to be something. I don't know how we determine that, but like, you're right. Like, there's got to be something that can hold these players accountable to play at a certain pace. And if you're the first player to get to the ball, the player who they determine is away. And again, that's another hang up there, is like determining who's away. A lot of times you don't figure it out until you get to your ball and you're like, oh, wait a second. How far are you? I'm 167. I'm 165. Okay, you're away. Now all of a sudden that player gets an extra 30 seconds. Like, but it takes a second to determine that. But like, again, well, like, who's regulating that shot clock? You know, and that's the other part. In baseball, it's very easy to determine that. You make a pitch.
No, I totally agree with you. But I think we have walking, I think has a walking score.
Mm-hmm.
And we may need to start training these people. And look, it's like, you know, the first person to get to their golf ball for 6 seconds. Second person gets 45 seconds. Third person gets 40 seconds. Whatever that looks like. I don't necessarily want to see someone sitting there holding a shot clock in their hands in the fairway. But we're not far away from to happen at the same time.
Yeah.
A 6-hour round in a professional event is absolutely absurd.
Yeah.
Professionals hit the, I mean, we all play golf and we play on golf courses with amateur golfers on a regular basis that play way worse than professionals do. Some guys don't need to think as much, take a little less time to think about their shots. But at the end of the day, when you get up over a golf ball, one, I think range finders should be a part of professional golf. I think at this point, range finders should be a part of professional golf. I think that helps speed up play. I don't see any advantage, if everyone's allowed to use them, that they should not have they should not have range finders in professional golf, especially when someone is well the fairway, trying to find a sprinkler head to walk it off. The caddy's trying to find a sprinkler head to walk it off. That takes way longer than it should. You have a yardage book. You know what the green is. If you can shoot the pin, you can get the front edge. All that math is there. I don't think at this point guys should still be walking off yardages the way that they have to in professional golf. I think ultimately rangefinders should be a part of it. I also think that that's only up in the right direction. I think that's the first step, in my opinion. If you want to speed up the pace of play, let's take some of the caddy work out of it. Let's speed it up from that side of things. Go ahead and let him shoot the flag. Let's figure out what it is. I mean, I think immediately that's the easiest, the absolute easiest avenue to go down to speed up pace of play.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know why they haven't done that yet.
You know what I'm saying? If everyone has one, and I'll say this, everyone should have one rangefinder on tour. It's the same rangefinder for every caddy. You have to have the exact same one. Everyone has the exact same one. You can't have a loophole or a Bushnell or whatever it is. You have one that's approved by the PGA Tour. and it may be a Tour V6 without slope, because they shouldn't have slope. I don't agree with them having slope, but I think you have one rangefinder. Every caddy has one. You're able to shoot the flag immediately. You're able to shoot the distance. You can backtrack everything off of that distance with your yardage book. But there's no reason that these guys need to be out there. A player needs to be standing next to their bag and a caddy still walking off yardages. That to me is a lack of involvement. That to me is losing the ability to utilize technology.
Yeah, I'd agree.
Yeah, I got no issue with any of that. I don't know if I have a solution either. I know I posed the question, but it was just, I don't know. It's gotta get better though. And I don't know if they make fields. I know we've had a lot of discussion on fields, but you could argue field size being a little bit smaller. You know, like the LPGA Tour this weekend, they had threesomes, which doesn't help. Like, I don't know what the number was on the cut, but I was surprised to see threesomes after the cut. Obviously, I get that Thursday, Friday. But you know, it's a problem on the PGA Tour too. These things are taking forever. It was nice to see. I heard an interview with Nelly Korda kind of bashing it. Was like, I couldn't stand it out there. It was driving me nuts. Like, yeah, I hate slow play.
She said that in her winning interview, like right off the,
yeah.
She's like, I was exhausted. It took forever. It was one of the longest rounds I've ever played, like 6 hours. And I mean, that's exhausting, you know, to stay that, especially when you're holding a lead, like you just have to stay on point for so long. Like it's a good extra hour and a half.
Well, and imagine your winner saying that. The person who just benefited the most is bringing that up as an issue. It's an issue.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's bad. And I think it's something that needs to be addressed to kind of get back to that Theo article of let's try to get a younger, more involved fan base here. Yeah. You know, my two girls were invested there for a minute. You lost them.
They lost interest.
You lost them.
So you've got to make some changes. You've got to speed it up. I mean, like, look, not to get into the Liv argument, but the one thing I give Liv's broadcast credit to is that it is quick. It shows golf nonstop, fast. And not to say it's a better product. It keeps you more intrigued. Like,
sure,
you're not listening to guys talk about the backstory of how he got here and what he had to go through with his travel. It's literally Rom on hole two.
Yeah.
AK on hole three. DJ hole four. And it just runs through it. Again, not arguing the product, just looking at the speed of things. And I do appreciate when I do watch Live, which is very rare, I do appreciate how quick it is.
Sure. I'll buy that. Not buying Live, but I'll buy that.
Fair enough.
Let's get Korn Ferry Tour. There was a couple headlines that I thought, obviously the big one that we'll get to in a second, but I just wanted to shout out Morgan Hoffman. You know, we talked about him last year and he's trying to make his comeback, living down in Costa Rica, all kinds of health issues, was leading there for a while. He had one bad round. I think he shot 73 on an easy golf course. Those guys were going low on the Korn Ferry Tour this week. He shot 73 in the third round. Falter. He finished T20. So a good finish. It's going to give him more starts and out there. So that was just kind of good to see. But big news. I'm sure if anyone's remotely interested in golf and on social media, Miles Russell, 15-year-old, makes the cut, shoots 66 final round, also finishes T20, and gets into this week's Korn Ferry Tour event. His kid's kind of good, I think, guys.
Kind of good.
Kind of. The kid's 111 pounds and finished T20 on the Korn Ferry, finished up with the last round 66.
Yeah. The kid's very mature, in my opinion. Like, I've seen him couple interviews on Instagram and so forth. But the kid, like, he's got his shit together in a roundabout way for 15-year-old, like, which is kind of cool to see. And then on top of that, he's super talented. Great golf swing. Hits it a mile for being 115 pounds. I mean, he's a little kid, but just smashes it, you know, which is, I mean, it's a great golf swing too. I've had a bunch of my students that I work with have already sent me, you know, videos of him and said, oh, look at this kid. He's 15. He's the number one, you know, junior in the world. I was like, yeah, this is, they're like, I want to do that. I'm like, great. Like, I want you to do that too. Like, this is, that's the tough part. It's just like, you know, there's a lot of things that go into this, you know. Like, you look at somebody like LeBron when he was 18 or 17, like, and he was the number one draft pick. Like, yes, everyone. I mean, yeah, you want to do that. Like, there's just some God-given things that, like, are going to make it tough for you to get to that point. And I don't want to say that they can't do that. I'm just saying, like, at this point in that kid's life, at 15, like, there's a lot of, you know, things that have lined up for this kid to make, you know, these great successes in his life. And I always say, you know, I would much rather be the number one, you know, amateur in the world, men's amateur, or the number one pro in the world than the number one junior in the world. And I granted, that's a great accomplishment, but there's been a lot of number one juniors in the world that you've never heard of. Yeah. So, you know, take that with a grain of salt, you know.
That's the thing I feel bad about the kid.
This kid may be on maybe at the next level for sure. I mean, it sounds like he's very mature and he's probably going to be a force to be reckoned with at some point, for sure. But
yeah, it was super impressive what he did. The kid has a ton of game, but like you said, I mean, a lot of things can happen between 15 and 25. And I just, in today's day and age, I feel bad for kids that do stuff like this, because then they just get just so much attention, so much expectations just heaped upon them, and like
too early,
and then everyone just thinks, oh, is gonna be the next Tiger Woods or the next LeBron James or the next Patrick Mahomes or whatever it may be. Like, just let the kid be a kid, you know.
Yeah,
enjoy it, tip your cap to him, like, really impressive. But let's remember, he's a 15-year-old kid, so I hope he doesn't get ruined. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, we've seen plenty of times. Another issue here, side note, McLean has lost power. So he's no longer with us. He froze there for a minute and now has lost power. I've been seeing low network bandwidth flash up on my screen like this whole time. So I got no idea what this podcast is going to sound like to our listeners. Hopefully it's not bad. But
I think it's
McLean,
okay.
McLean has abruptly signed off and not under his power, or I should say. So hopefully he can get back on here for the show. But I think we'll keep this train rolling right now. All right. So I guess it was kind of a slow week in the world of golf. We got Rory McIlroy's back on the policy board again.
There we go. He's just now committed amongst the $850 million, you know, potential payout to Rumor to go to Live, which he is, you know, immediately shot down and said that's not a thing.
And now he's back on the board.
I always think, you know, I always say where there's smoke, there's fire. Like, I don't think no one just is going to come up with this $850 million. You know, idea out of thin air. So it must have been thrown around at some point. Now, whether Rory just used it and said, no, I'm not interested, maybe, but like, it didn't come out of nowhere. You know, like, it wasn't like people just come up with that number on their own. And I mean, maybe somebody just did it, but for the most part, seems like, from what we've seen in the past.
Yeah, I mean, the only thing is that the source it came from was like a financial newspaper in London that has never reported on golf before in its life. Mm-hmm. And then throw that out there is a little weird and random.
Mm-hmm.
Not to say they don't know, you know, a Saudi or whatever, or someone that, oh, said, I, you know, I heard this, or I don't know. He shut it down pretty quick, and now he's back on the policy board. I guess Webb Simpson resigned to get him back on, or I don't know. I don't really care. Again, I'm sick of talking about boards and policy shit with these guys. I know it will be fascinating to hear. Apparently, tomorrow they're announcing to the players like who gets what equity in the new enterprise.
Wow. Like what level you're at. Like I'm guessing they're basing it off of PGA starts, career money, and a bunch of factors similar to what they do with the pension.
Yeah, they had those tiers. They had those tiers that came out that was leaked a couple months ago. So I guess we'll have some news to discuss next week on that. It's supposed to be announced to the players tomorrow, which you know is going to get leaked to the media. So that will be out at some point. Yeah. But So McLean's power is still out. We're just going to get to our picks. If he shows up, he shows up. I can tell you, if you want to hear McLean's picks, go to pjtour.com, search their power rankings. And it's gonna be tough here.
I bet it would be tough for him to get his picks from the power rankings because won't be enough funds there to make that happen. This is actually a pretty tough week. And I'm not going to lie. I'm going to give you my picks, but there's a good chance that these may be changed before the start.
I'm kind of in the same boat. I hate this event. I don't know how to do this. It's awkward. So for the listeners, Zurich, the two-man event, it's the Zurich Classic two-man. It's actually got a surprisingly good field. In all honesty, you get Cantlay and Xander as a team. Rory's playing with Shane Lowry. You got Zalatoris and Thagala. You get Morikawa's playing with Kitayama. Fitzpatrick's playing with his brother. You got a pretty decent field. The Hogard brothers. So,
yeah.
Yeah. All right. You want to go first?
I guess.
I did win last week. That's none of us had great picks last week, but I did win.
Just so you know. Sure. I've been on a really poor streak here. Mike and I have a golf pool that we're in, and we're doing very poorly. And it didn't help that we didn't submit a lineup twice early in the year, but we're doing poorly in that. I've the last 4 or 5 weeks I've done poorly in this. I've got another pool that we're in with Chris Paquette, our good buddy. He puts on this. It's a good pool. It's fun. It's 15 guys. And I've done so shitty in that too. It's just like the last month has been a mess for me in my golf pool picks. But, and you know, this week is no different. Like, cause it's just such a strange event. Like, it's like, I don't even know who to pick. Like, I don't even know where to go. You can't pick two of the same guy and the same. You can basically only pick one of the partners. If I see a team that I think is going to do well, I'm like, oh, I want to pick both of these guys, but you can't do that. So, needless to say, this is probably not a great pick, but I'm going to start at the top, and I'm going with McIlroy and Lowry at 10,700 at the top. And who knows? I never know with Rory. I just never know. I don't know if it's maybe they get have some great camaraderie there, being the Irish guys, and they can make it work. Then from there, I drop down quite a bit, and I go from to Thomas Dietrich and Rob McIntyre, $8,500. Dietrich's had played decently here last year. Then $8,200. Daniel Berger and Perez again. You know, this is all a guess at this point. So I hate to even say that. I'm full disclosure to our listeners. Normally, I usually have a rhyme to my reason here, but I don't really know with this event. It's weird. Then $8,000, Andrew Putnam and Mr. Highsmith. Who knows? But yeah, I mean, I obviously I've looked at what they've done in the past and where they're playing. So this is a conglomerate of their past history here at this event and their recent playing. So $7,500 I've got Nick Hardy and Riley. They've played well here in the past. I think they won here 2 years ago. I'm pretty sure they won here 2 years ago.
Yeah, I think they did.
Good. Okay. Then I'm not a complete idiot. So that makes me feel better. Lastly, I've got Chad Ramey and Martin Trainer, two players that I've played a lot of, I shouldn't say a lot of golf with. They were young bucks when I was finishing up, and Chad Ramey, Texan. I'm pretty sure he's a Texan, but really good ball striker. He is a great ball striker, and Martin Trainer, a little bit more erratic, but can make some birdies. Eccentric guy. I spent some time with him in South America. I really liked him. He was a fun guy to be around. If you haven't, has he won twice on the PGA Tour? I think at least once.
Once.
But he's such a unique guy. And if I really hope that they get in the mix so they can start talking about these two guys. And Chad's such a quiet guy. He's not going to talk about himself at all. And Martin is, if you get him going and you start talking to him, he's a super bright guy, which I really loved. And I spent a lot of time with him just because he was pretty, I wouldn't say he's fluent Spanish, but pretty close. And I was like, I need to align myself with some people who can speak Spanish when I'm down here in South America. And he was one. And we kind of hit it off. He was a kind of unique guy. And, I don't know. We had a good time. He wouldn't be a guy that you would think that I would be paired with. He's a very smart guy, way smarter than me, like not even close. Like he's like 10 levels ahead of me, but I liked him because he was super smart. And for whatever reason, he didn't get annoyed with me being around him. So I was like, okay, this is a good mix. But, some of those guys, you know, again, not to, that's my lineup, but to kind of touch on what we were talking about earlier real quickly, you know, for the viewership and the PGA Tour, like some of these guys are, you know, really intricate, eccentric, and they've got a lot to offer. I'm hoping that we can learn more about some of these guys. And that's something we've pushed for the last couple of years is like, I want to know more about these young guys that we don't know about. Like you played the Korn Ferry Tour, or you played the PGA Tour Latin America, or you played the PGA Tour Canada or PGA Tour China. Like, who are these guys? Like, what's their backstory? You know, you'd be surprised at how quickly you could latch on to some of these players and create, you know, some loyalty and push some of the viewership when you can make that connection, you know, whether it be from the same area or same interests or whatever. You know, you never know. I don't know. I just, you know, those are two guys that I've played some golf with that are pretty cool guys, and they're talented players, obviously. So I'll be pulling for them this week. But anyway, that's my weird lineup. I did as much research as I could without, you know, without really knowing what the hell I was doing, because this is a weird event. So anyway,
yeah,
Mikey, what you got?
I had not played with any. Professionally with any of my squad, so I'll just let the listeners know that. So all right, I'm gonna start.
That obviously shouldn't be a prerequisite, because I've played with a lot of them, and I think I'm in last place now with in terms of our points. But whatever, that'll change.
So start at the bottom, kind of shot in the dark here. Callum Tarran and David Skins.
Oh, that's nice. The Brits.
The two Brits, good buddies. They could yuck it up out there, have a little fun, get loose. Skins, you know, played well, you know, a few weeks ago at Houston. So cheap, $6,400. So I'll go with them. Then I'm going to go up to Justin Lauer and Dylan Wu. Lauer played well last week. Dylan Wu's had a pretty steady year, so I like them. Then I will go up to 7,700. Taylor Moore and Matthew Neesmith. Taylor Moore has been having a really good year. The two of them have paired up together at this before and have had great success. Actually have finished fourth the last 2 years. So I'm going to see if they can keep that going. Then I go to just a group I would love to just follow and hang out with. $8,800, Keith Mitchell and Joel Damon.
That sounds like a good time, doesn't it?
I just think it's just going to be a good time. They're going to have a ton of laughs. I think it's going to help both of them play a little bit looser and play well. Simple as that.
How good is Keith Mitchell's golf swing, by the way?
So much better than he is.
He really should.
His results should be so much better than he.
I haven't dug into his stats, but like watching his golf swing, somebody just sent me a video of him. Like it was kind of a couple face on views with the 3-wood and then a down the line with like an iron. I'm like that is
pretty damn solid.
Incredible golf swing. Like it is really good. I mean, he smashes it. I'm like,
he gets the hell out of it. Yeah.
What's the holdup here? You know,
I know his short game chipping and putting had never been maybe it's great. Average. I know he's been working hard on the chipping and pitching.
But. And he's still a great, I mean, let's just be honest. Still. He's like, basically a top 50 player in the world. So, I mean, or close to it. I mean, I don't know exactly, but he's pretty close to that. So he's great. But like you watch a golf swing like that and you're like, oh man, I feel like
you just think you'd get a little bit more out of it.
Yeah. You know? You feel like they should be in contention more. But anyway, kudos to you, Keith Mitchell. You're doing the right thing. Keep wearing the cashmere, bro. Keep wearing the cashmere.
Then my last two teams, 9,200 Canadians, Nick Taylor, Adam Hadwin, just both having solid years. I think both are underrated players. They have both paired together at this event before, were runners up last year. So I like them to have another high finish. And then I'm going to go with your winners, $10,300, Sahith Theegala and Will Zalatoris. I just love that pairing, and you know, just love it.
I had him in my lineup program.
There you go. Kind of like Jay. Not a ton of rhyme or reason. A little research. It's just an awkward event to try to pick.
It is tough.
So
that's a good lineup, though. I like it. Well, McLean, how about your lineup? What do you think? Oh,
let's see. Well, the power rankings. Power rankings have Patrick Cantlay and Xander Schauffele number one. Go figure. We have Sahith and Will 2. We have Nick Taylor and Adam Hadwin 3. Shane Lowry and McIlroy 4. You know.
No.
So
yeah. You can't put four of those guys in one lineup. It's too expensive.
I have three teams. I got Taylor Moore and Matt Neesmith. That's surprising. Power rankings. How about me? Look at that.
How about you? Power ranking follower. You are just succumb to the mainstream media there. Go for
it, Mike. He's kicking our ass. Clint's kicking our ass, and thus he uses the power rankings every week.
Every week. He doesn't even try to lie about it. He's just like, this is what I do. Like, you guys should do it. And we don't. That's the funny part. Like he's still one of my
favorite moments of the show was that first. But, all right, that'll do it for us, McLean. Hopefully lighting candles in the dark there, and hopefully this wasn't just completely terrible audio like it could be. We'll find out in the morning when I edit it, but to our listeners, thanks as always. Hopefully it was good. Sorry about the rollback, rough talk at the beginning, and we'll be back for another episode next week. Cheers.